Have you considered the degree to which your primary role as an entrepreneur is the management of expectations, including your own? Stephen Phelan explains.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute to apply the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free resources and comprehensive show notes, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. That's Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. Today, we're talking about expectations and how to manage them. Economist George Shackle called expectations imaginary situations with named future dates attached to a belief that we can make them come true. It's imagining the future with a deadline for your imagination to be proven accurate. Well, as entrepreneurs, we're supposed to imagine the future. That's our job. But you should also consider that expectations are fundamental to successful entrepreneurship. Sometimes you have to create high expectations for potential customers, investors, distributors, and retailers you sell through, the loan officer at your bank, suppliers you want to cultivate, and possibly your spouse. Sometimes you want to create lesser expectations for sellers, for example, where you want to purchase a resource or a service that you think is more valuable than they do, or for competitors, amongst whom you want to cultivate the expectation that you are less of a threat than you really are. But obviously, there is a risk. If you create expectations that are too high for your retailer, for example, you might get delisted if you fail to hit those targets. If you create too high expectations for an investor or a lender, you're going to have a challenging relationship and difficulty in raising future funds. Being good at expectations management is important, and it's tricky. Two parties in any trade or exchange are going to have different views about the value of any resource. The employee may expect a more generous stream of future wages and bonuses and benefits than the entrepreneur thinks is justified by the future revenue streams that employee helps to create. The supplier who is selling you a service is trying to create an expectation that they will create more value than perhaps you think is reasonable. What's the answer? Well, it's negotiation between the two parties, finding a zone of agreement. Even better, it's the absence of negotiation, the creation of a climate in which stakeholders renegotiate less frequently, or not at all, because they're satisfied with existing arrangements. In other words, expectations were created just right. That's what we can call successful expectations management. So I think you can see that expectations management is a significant skill for the entrepreneur. It helps to control costs on the buy side, develop long-term relationships on the sell side, and contributes to access to human and physical capital, as well as access to distribution. It also helps you keep personally stable. If your expectations are in the right place, you won't be excessively disappointed or excessively euphoric about performance and results. We are joined today by Stephen Phelan, a return visitor. Stephen is helping us to demonstrate the power of Austrian economics principles when applied to business, making entrepreneurs more effective. He's a researcher and a teacher in the field of entrepreneurship, and he's made a special study of the role of expectations management. Stephen is Distinguished Professor of Entrepreneurship at Fayetteville, North Carolina, where he teaches MBA courses in entrepreneurial strategy and finance, as well as business growth strategies and new venture creation. Stephen, hello.
Hi, how are we doing today?
Very good. Thank you for joining us once again on Economics for Entrepreneurs. You prepared some very impactful research into a subject called expectations management. And you found that it's a fundamental and foundational skill for entrepreneurs, so much so that you titled your paper, Entrepreneurship as Expectations Management. Do you have a definition of expectations management? If somebody asked you, What is expectations management? What would you say?
So it's an attempt to change someone's opinion about the value of a resource or control somebody's opinion, much like you might do with public relations, where you're trying to present a positive image of the organization you're representing. The same thing is happening with the entrepreneur with their business idea. They're trying to shape the opinions or beliefs around their idea so that people are favorably disposed to contribute or in some other way help them out.
I mentioned in the intro to our listeners that expectations are creative and imaginary.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you thinking when you attach the word management to something that's creative and imaginary?
Well, I think to paraphrase Donne, no person is an island when it comes to expectations or beliefs. So we're constantly surrounded by influences that help to shape the beliefs that we have, even though it's something personal to us and something that's internal to our own cognitive processes. We're not alone when we have those processes acting on our own choices and decisions. And so the easiest way to point to this, of course, is just to look at all of the different areas in modern day life that attempt to influence our beliefs. So, you know, politics, for example, or religion, or public relations firms, advertising are constantly bombarding us with messages trying to influence our beliefs and expectations, usually in a way that benefits those who are paying for it. So it comes as no surprise that entrepreneurs may want to do the same sort of thing themselves.
So you're saying that entrepreneurs need to be active and purposeful, that's a favorite word for us Austrians, in changing opinions about the values of a resource. People may have different opinions, and the entrepreneurial job is to change that opinion.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you look at entrepreneurship in sort of the cold light of day, you recognize that there's two things going on. There's a liability of newness and a liability of smallness. So a lot of research has been done on organizations of different sizes and ages, and a lot of that research indicates that new companies and small companies are much more likely to fail than large companies or companies that have been around for a while. So everything else being equal, why would anyone want to invest in something with a high risk of failure on favorable terms? So your job as an entrepreneur is to try and overcome that natural bias that people might have of viewing your venture as a liability, and try to convince them that, no, we're different in some way. And if you can do that, obviously you can acquire resources such as workers, financing, and equipment and so forth on more favorable terms. Everything else being equal, you would have a risk premium for a small or new company. And one of the things you have to do is overcome that as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, we certainly find that in the startup world, Steve, as you're alluding to, that just the perspective of a potential customer who believes that you're not ready, or you're not mature enough, or let's wait until you get bigger, is certainly an expectation that has to be overcome. So I get the point. We talked about resources. You said changing the perception of a value of a resource is expectations management. And last time we were here, you talked about resource management. So are we in the same area where this is part of resource management?
Yeah, so the resource-based view sees the resources and the way you deploy those resources as the basis for the services that any business provides to its customers. So the process of getting rights to those resources, whether through ownership or through contracts with employees, for example, gives you the ability to direct the use of those resources, to profit from the services that you provide with those resources, and ultimately the right to sell those resources in the case of physical assets as well. So the way you're managing the resources or the resource management process is key to the resource-based view that we've talked about previously.
Yeah, and I've got a kind of a sidebar question there. You talk about these three rights to obtain income from the resource. Can you have those rights without ownership if you're renting those resources? Or are you
absolutely
using
so there's all sorts of economic institutions to facilitate transactions between resource holders. Since slavery has been banned, you cannot own human resources, obviously. So one of the issues there is that you're always contracting with your people, and other sorts of resources, like physical resources, for example, are something that you can own. But ultimately, any sort of agreement you have is really a bundle of rights that you have. And there's a property rights school of economics that sees these different rights that are conferred with different sorts of transactions. So this is an example of what am I actually getting when I transact and acquire a resource or acquire the right to use somebody's labor and so forth. So, and it's not just rights, of course, there's obligations as well that both parties have. It's very much a negotiation of what goes on.
Right, and we were saying in our introduction that the expectations management can take place as a negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
But you said in your paper, the ideal condition is no negotiation, that both parties are comfortable with the expectations that have been set. So is that the goal, to get beyond negotiation?
Well, I've taught negotiations before, and I had one takeaway from that course from a master negotiator where he was saying you always leave something on the table so people feel like they've got a good deal, you know. And he said one of the goals of negotiation is to make people feel good about the transaction. So it's not necessarily about getting the absolute best, lowest price you possibly can through every underhanded tactic. It's about thinking about the relationship and your reputation moving forward in all things. So it's a very holistic view of this resource process.
Right, and that's part of the exchange theory, I think, that both sides need to feel that they got a benefit from the exchange.
Right, and we know from things like ultimatum games that people are not very happy if they perceive that they got a bad deal in a negotiation. And for those who don't know, the ultimatum game is where you get to offer somebody a split of a dollar. And so it can be anywhere from a penny to 99 cents. And standard economic theory would say somebody should be happy with a penny, right? Because they were a penny better off than they were before they started the game. And yet people typically try and make the split closer to 50%, because the second rule is that you only get paid if somebody accepts your deal. And so you find that people tend to move towards fairness rather than just, hey, you're one penny better off, because they recognize that people often don't see that as fair. So there's
right. Precedent there. Yeah, that's what Deirdre McCloskey says, that people are not utility maximizers. There are many other incentives.
Oh.
But in your paper, Steve, you talked about a four-stage entrepreneurial journey or process.
Mm-hmm.
You entitled them the identification stage, the assembly stage, the maintenance stage, although I prefer the growth stage,
mm-hmm.
and then the exit or release phase.
Mm-hmm.
So just quickly summarize that journey process as you see it, and then we'll perhaps dig into managing expectations at every stage.
Absolutely. So the identification stage is that first stage of having an expectation or belief that arranging resources in a certain way is going to yield profit for you, or if you like to talk in terms of utility, greater utility. So often in an entrepreneurial for-profit sense, we're thinking about profit, but it equally applies to utility maximization. So you're seeing an opportunity, essentially, and so that's the identification stage. And you clearly have to manage your own beliefs there, manage yourself, because one thing we know from our research on entrepreneurs is that want-to-be entrepreneurs tend to be very overconfident. They tend to think that the opportunity is a lot bigger than maybe a casual bystander might believe. So it's one of the first tasks that you need to do is manage yourself and your own expectations.
Let me just latch onto that a little bit, Steve. So you said there's growing evidence that entrepreneurs are likely to have inflated expectations about the future. And what's the data on that? How do you come to that conclusion? And then what's the solution to solve that problem?
Well, there's been a lot of research in entrepreneurial personalities and behaviors over the years, and this tends to be a fairly consistent finding that nascent entrepreneurs or those planning to start a business tend to have a high level of confidence in themselves, which some see as perhaps necessary to get into a risky business. But the same sort of research also shows that successful entrepreneurs, or those that are still in business, for example, 5 years later, tend to have lower levels of confidence. So they're much more controlled in their beliefs about what's possible. And so I guess one of the first things that I would advise budding entrepreneurs is to really surround yourself with advisors or mentors who may be able to provide a reality check and this sort of exuberance that tends to go along with new ideas.
There's an expression that some of the economists use for entrepreneurs, saying that they embrace uncertainty. So what I'm seeing or hearing you say is maybe they shouldn't embrace it quite so tightly and have a more tempered approach.
I don't think there's a problem embracing uncertainty as long as you recognize it's uncertainty and don't think it's a sure thing.
Mm-hmm.
Often people believe that they're seeing something that no one else can and that they've got some sort of unique insight that no one else has. Sometimes
so your advice then is to get lots of opinions and perspectives from people who may be qualified as experienced or
mm-hmm.
they're experts on the industry or they have some perspective that is valid. Is that essentially
yeah,
right?
I think that's a good piece of advice. And obviously successful entrepreneurs or people who've been in entrepreneurship for a long period of time are always, I find, happy to mentor younger entrepreneurs and to provide that advice. And often I find budding entrepreneurs very guarded and jealously holding on to this idea when in fact it might be better to share it a little bit wider and get some input from those who may have been down that path before.
Does the data say that people who have been multiple entrepreneurs, or you know, as the business books say, they've failed and tried again,
mm-hmm.
does that help them to temper excessive expectations?
I think the research does say that, actually, and that as you get more experience and you learn more and you realize what doesn't work, you actually set yourself up for success. So in one sense, trying and failing is good advice, but I would also say fail fast and fail cheaply. So don't bet the farm necessarily that you're 100% right.
Yeah, I don't particularly like the word fail, but learning what works and what doesn't. And
yes.
And my way of stating that is always to have two piles, what works and what doesn't. And right. If you can sort those out, then you're ahead of the game.
And I tell my students, you know, Edison says, you know, he had 1,000 tries to find the light bulb, right? He didn't
mm-hmm.
fail. He just found 999 ways it didn't work.
Yep. Yeah, I've heard Jimmy Wales make that same speech, the founder of Wikipedia, the number mm-hmm. of times Jimmy Wales has failed before Wikipedia became a success. So it's good learning. Let me just take a moment to remind our listeners that if you have questions or comments about any E4E podcast, you can find us on LinkedIn at Mises.business/group. It's our LinkedIn group page. It's for discussion and conversation, and you can interact with us there. We'd love to hear from you. And I know for a fact that Steve Phelan joined the group, so if you have any questions for him about today's podcast, he'd be glad to respond. And now back to our conversation. So here we are, Steve. We've tempered our expectations. We've gone through the identification stage. We think we have a business model where we've gotten advice and results from testing and so on like that, and we've decided to go ahead. And you call the next stage, I think, the assembly stage, when you're
correct.
Assembling the capital and resources that you need. So talk about expectations management in that step.
Well, this is a very interesting stage. I was racking my brain for a good example to share with your listeners, and I settled on Christopher Columbus as a great example. So
a great entrepreneur.
Yeah, so I was actually in the Canary Islands last year and got to see where he set sail for the New World. And, of course, he had this belief that he could reach the Indies by sailing west. So there's an example of identifying that opportunity we're talking about. Obviously, he was a little wrong with his belief there, but it was certainly motivating him enough to want to go out and do something about it. So what happens then? So we all know the story that he started going around to different courts in Europe trying to get money to buy ships and provisions and assemble a crew and so forth. And you can imagine this is a pretty hard sell. And so let's sail where no one's ever gone before, where no one ever comes back, sort of thing. And so he had to negotiate, right? And he had to sell people on this vision of the wealth that could be obtained and the benefits that could be obtained by investing in this venture. Of course, from the Queen Isabella's point of view, she was just putting money in, some say a substantial sum of money. But Columbus was betting a lot more with his life, and he was also doing that with the crew, and the crew had to have an enormous amount of trust or a belief in what he was trying to do. So, you know, he had a story, he had a map, people knew that you could keep sailing west, and they knew what the winds were and so forth, so he wasn't a complete lunatic. But he certainly had a lot of selling to do, and we know the story that it didn't work when he went to Portugal, and eventually went to the Spanish court and was able to convince people of the merits of the idea. And so then the question is, what price do you pay? And so now you're into that negotiation phase. Okay, I'm interested in funding you, Columbus. What do I get from this? And it actually turns out that the Spanish crown drove a hard bargain and were able to claim 7/8 of anything that he got from his voyages, leaving him with 1/8. And I believe he put 10% of the money in himself from loans that he took out. So
that's pretty vicious venture capital ratio.
Yeah. So it certainly wasn't free. And so, but obviously there was an enormous risk involved. And so he had to give something up. But in at the end, he was able to get everything he needed and start that voyage, right?
Yeah, that's a great example. If Columbus was alive today, he'd have a pitch deck for for Silicon Valley, or he'd have a business case to take to his bank or his local lender. And just to riff on your example a little bit, now the price that the lenders or the providers of capital can exact is kind of settled into a zone. We know how much equity we'll give up to a venture capitalist. We know what we'll pay for a loan from the bank or from one of the online lending chains. So in that sense, expectations management gets a bit institutionalized. Is that a fair way to look at it?
Well, I think when you look at the stories that come out of Silicon Valley and how many VC pitches people have to do, I'm not sure their entrepreneur would say it's just a matter of following the playbook. They would argue that there's a lot of perception management and, you know, everyone's watching everybody else and what they're doing and who they're going to see and working their hardest to shape perceptions to get a chance to get in front of a VC group, for example. So I would probably say it's not as institutionalized as perhaps it seems from the other side, maybe.
Okay. You say in your paper then that the entrepreneur has several avenues for obtaining what you call control over required resources. And you give a range from bootstrapping to financial exchange to social exchange. So talk about that. Should the entrepreneur be thinking about a wide range of ways to negotiate their way to this control of resources?
Absolutely. So, you know, the first thing is to tap your network, family and friends, or as entrepreneurship professors like to say, the three F's, family, friends, and fools. See if somebody's willing to give you money for free, right? And certainly there are grants out there and economic development schemes and family and others that are willing to support your dreams. And that should be your first port of call, because that's the cheapest money in a sense. And your own sweat equity falls into that category as well. Not needing to have resources is a good way of minimizing the cost of your resource acquisition. Mm-hmm. Working from home, having a home office, working out of the garage, as we know so many Silicon Valley founders did. They're all ways of conserving the need for resources. And then, of course, when you actually need to go out into the market and raise funds and so forth, then you're in this negotiation period and everything that you can do to influence the perception of your company, that you're a solid venture, that you have things organized, that you know what you're going to do. So there's a million and one different tricks that you can do to present the facade that you're a serious entrepreneur. For example, having a very solid board of directors or board of advisors that other people recognize. And later on, maybe we can talk about the Theranos example, but one of the reasons that Elizabeth Holmes was able to raise so much money was the strength of the board that she put together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, who your lead investors are, who's who have come in, that all of that signals to other investors how serious your venture is, where you have your offers. How you dress, how you talk, how you organize your pitch deck, all of these things are constantly sending signals about your credibility.
So. Yeah, and the other side of that, it strikes me, Steve, is that you need to exercise some empathy with the party you're negotiating with to understand how their expectations are formed. So you gave an example that an expectation might be formed based on your board of directors. Another one might be formed based on your frugality in the use of resources. So is there an empathetic way to find out from the parties you're negotiating with how they form expectations? Is that part of expectations management?
I think there's always a lot of scuttlebutt when you go into incubators and accelerators of different groups talking about their experience with different investors and what seems to get them excited and so forth, and who they target, what industries they're interested in, and how they like the entrepreneurs to appear before them and so forth. So I think there is an informal approach to that already going on, and clearly calling up people who've already dealt with them or that are invested in that. Received investment from that company or pitched before that company is a good way to get a handle on what it is that the firm stands for. So, yeah, I think there are techniques that you can use to increase the odds that you're going to get funded.
But also in this assemble stage, I might be trying to hire some people. I have them join the venture. Let's say I'm just a growing local plumbing business and I want to attract somebody from another plumbing business, and I'm trying to assemble my labor force. I need to understand how they form expectations too, wouldn't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I think if it was purely a financial compensation deal, then as I said earlier, this liability of newness and smallness means you're probably a bad bet for a talented employee. And so you need to be able to offer something else in exchange other than hard cash up front. Traditionally, that's been things like stock options. And so that now if you're giving someone stock options, they have to believe that at some point they're going to be able to exercise those options and that you're going to go public or get acquired. So you're going to need a story there that keeps people motivated to contribute. So it's one of the reasons that you can attract high-grade talent is through those sort of expectations about the future and about the potential payoffs. And then, you mentioned social exchange, which is about giving things other than financial compensation. And, you know, people have all sorts of things that they're looking for in their life. It may be the ability to work from home. It may be the social environment that you provide, the culture of the company, that it's, you know, freewheeling, for example, or, you know, they have more authority or they're more involved in decision making. All these little things in themselves are ways that you can exchange something in for someone's services that don't necessarily require cash compensation. And so you see a lot of startups, you know, selling the culture of their company as a reason to come and work with them rather than just the compensation.
Yeah, and the expectation of the individual you're trying to attract will be, yes, there's contingent compensation that I might get in bonuses and equity, but it'll be a fun place to work. It'll be a more stimulating journey. I guess those are expectations too.
Absolutely. And so it's finding ways to stimulate other things that people care about, or even down to I can bring my dog to work.
Yeah.
So that's why right. They work at a point.
Play football and so on.
Mm-hmm. So all of
okay. Those. So we've assembled our physical capital, financial capital, human capital in our second phase. And you go to the next stage in your model, Steve. You call it maintain stage, but we like to think of it as the grow stage. We're in the ready, set, go, grow business. And you say that the focus of expectations management now shifts to customers, suppliers, and competitors. So let's look at that through the maintain stage lens.
So all sorts of things start to happen when you launch your venture. So if we go back to Columbus, of course, famously faced down a mutiny that he had, that the crew wanted to turn back after 60 days. And so it was interesting that obviously that was a leadership moment where he had to do some fast talking and some fast thinking to keep people excited about what was ahead. I was actually reading today that he used to underreport the distance that they traveled. So he'd estimate they did 50 leagues and then he would write down the log 47 because he wanted the crew to have the expectation that they were in for a long journey. Mm-hmm. And so he deliberately underreported so that he was influencing their expectations in that sense. So when they did finally land, it wasn't as bad as we thought it was going to be.
Good job. He didn't have gap accounting in those days.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's just an interesting little story about
expectations management at work.
You know, I had a student once who told me quite proudly that he wouldn't be working for the company he was working with unless they awarded stock options. And so I asked a couple of questions and found it was a privately held company. And so I'm like, well, the stock options won't be worth anything unless you're acquired or do an IPO or something. And he said, oh, yes, but they bring somebody in every quarter to value what our options would be worth if we did that.
Yeah, I get it.
It's interesting.
Let's look at customers.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, so, you say that expectations management of customers is part of the skill of the entrepreneur. What do you have in mind there?
There's all sorts of things that go on when you're a small company. Obviously, everything being equal, people don't necessarily want to take a risk with a startup or with a new company or a new idea. And so any way that you can project stability or value or relative to competitors in that sense, then you're going to be ahead of the game. So, you know, and we're getting into the realms of marketing, of public relations, of image creation, and so forth. This, you know, one of the things that the internet did, of course, and the dot-com era was that it leveled the playing field in terms of real estate. In a sense, everyone can have a website. You can make your website look pretty professional without necessarily a large investment. So keeping up in that sense, showing that you have the same capability as competitors is managing the expectations of your customers, for example.
Yeah. One of the ones I came across a lot in my entrepreneurial life was insurance.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of customers said you got to have a certain level of errors and omissions insurance.
Right.
That, created some kind of sense of stability through insurance, but mm-hmm. That was one.
Warranties are another thing, or guarantees, yep. Or return policies. They're all signals that you're solid and dependable.
Right. So the entrepreneur's got to be thinking about the image of the company that he represents when he's looking at it through the eyes of the customer. It might be bigger and more sophisticated. So that's a kind of an empathy. And you say that it's creating trust is what we're trying to do here. Is that right?
No, that's correct. So at the end of the day, I have to believe that if I give you my business, that I'm going to receive the service that I think I'm going to receive. And so in that sense, I'm trusting that you're going to be able to deliver that you're not going to go out of business tomorrow and so forth. So so it becomes a very important element of doing business.
And a lot of the entrepreneurial strategy in B2B emphasizes that you're not just selling or trying to create a contractual relationship with one person. There are often many people. There's the direct client, there's the procurement agent, there's the compliance officer, there's the executive suite, there's HR. And so we've got to manage expectations with each one of those on an individual basis.
Correct. And, you know, I once personally ended a business venture with somebody where I didn't manage the partner's expectations of my business partner, his wife in this case, and she decided that I was steering him away from his calling in the ministry and towards business, and promptly put an end to that. So
expectations management is multifaceted. I can see that. You call the fourth stage of your entrepreneurial journey map here release. And the critical management task is maximization of the resources as you release them. What are you thinking of here?
Well, there's so many different angles on this. I guess the primary one that people think about is the startup that goes to an IPO, or they go to an acquisition, and so you're negotiating the stock price, and even with a venture capitalist, in a way, you're selling part of the company, and you're trying to negotiate what percentage you're giving up for a given amount of injection of capital and so forth. So in that sense, you need to be able to manage expectations, you know, having multiple bidders coming in and keeping people, playing them off against one another is a classic technique that people use in those situations, of course. Even to the point of, you know, releasing an employee, there are better and worse ways of doing that. You don't want somebody to sabotage the company on the way out because they're so upset at the way they were treated. So treating people with respect and managing and exits from the company are equally about managing expectations.
Right. I was thinking about this as we talk about Austrian capital theory and the resource-based view of the firm. We talk about dynamic flexibility, being able to respond quickly to changes in the marketplace and the environment, and that involves what we call shuffling and reshuffling resources. And so part of that is exiting, releasing, and that's how expectations management is focused on the acquirer. We've got to get them to have the highest possible opinion of the resources that we are, as you say, releasing.
Absolutely. And interestingly, I was at a wedding a few weeks ago and met a broker from Miami, and he gave me these words of wisdom that you make money when buying property, not selling it, which is another way of thinking about expectations management, if you like, that you're always thinking about the eventual release when you're buying, and that you want to get the best possible price up front, and it makes what happens later on a lot easier to digest, regardless of where the market goes.
Right. But also it's release sounds like an exit event, but actually it's not. It's about this continuous reshuffling and rearrangement of the resources you've got.
Absolutely. And as you say, with growth and so forth, and you're constantly bringing new people into the firm, and you know, one of the challenges that we hear about sometimes is startups often give glorious titles to people and find, you know, that somebody's not really CFO material for a much larger company. And you have to manage that transition as well. Some advice is to just not give people big titles early on and you know, say that you're reserving that. That sort of thing is managing expectations. Even vesting schedules are managing expectations, if you think of it in that way as well, where people earn back a certain amount of their shares over time as long as they stay with the company. So you're providing a belief that I need to stay with the company in order to get some sort of reward there, that it's contingent on my performance.
So skill at expectations management is a resource itself for the entrepreneur at every one of these stages: identify, assemble, maintain, and release. I've got to develop the skill at expectations management. Have you, over the years, Steve, found ways of enhancing that? Is it about experience? Is it about technique? Is it about developing one's own empathy? How do entrepreneurs get good at expectations management?
Well, I think the first thing is realizing that it's important that the terms on which you acquire or dispose of assets or human resources are not random, that they're, you know, that you can move the needle, you can have things tilted in your favor if you work at it. I find taking courses on negotiation are a good way to open yourself to that mindset. But equally, I think things like leadership and culture become important. So as we talked about, the culture of the company being a social exchange is equally as important as how good you are at driving hard bargains in negotiation. And so I think it's a very big tent when you think about it that way. And so it opens the door to the softer skills, as you point out, those leadership, culture, empathy, and so forth. So I think those are things that you can practice, that you can improve on, that you can look at how others are doing, model yourself on their behavior, practice on a smaller scale. But certainly, I believe a lot of these things are capable of development.
Yeah, good. Is there a metric, do you think, for skill at expectations management? I'm thinking as a parallel, the Net Promoter Score, which is about the quality of the experience. So I wonder if I have a metric about I trust these people or I trust this company or...
Yeah.
Can you think of a metric that might be useful?
Well, Net Promoter is an interesting one because, you know, would you recommend this organization to family and friends? So it is a measure of trust in that sense and how well liked you are by your customer base. I've actually introduced a Net Promoter Score here at the university for our students so that we're measuring how they perceive us. And so that's something that we can then act on, particularly if there are differences between programs. What's one program doing that the other one isn't? These are things I think you can measure and actively work on. A lot of it is just mindfulness when you're doing these deals as an entrepreneur to realize that, you know, there are, as you said, zones of agreement or areas that you can negotiate within on almost anything. And it's not necessarily those hard bargains, as I said, but also those soft skills.
Yeah, that's a good paradox to think about, hard bargains versus soft skills and developing trust. Let's spin the telescope around and say, what happens when expectations management goes wrong? Have you observed cases like that? Have you observed symptoms? Have you found red flags for people to look for that says this is an expectations management problem?
Well, I think there's two ways that it can go wrong. I think the first one is that you create a very negative expectation around yourself or your business just because of some behaviors you may exhibit, for example. And I'm sure you've seen plenty of pictures where you recognize that was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
All of the literature you read on what makes a bad pitch would certainly fall into that category. But one thing I see in particular is coachability. So often things that really rub investors or experienced entrepreneurs the wrong way is when somebody refuses any advice, just can't be coached or helped or anything. And you know, they're 100% sure they have the right answer to everything and all they need is your money and so forth. And so beyond whether that's true or not, you know, you have to think about the message that it sends to the investor or to the board of advisors or someone that's trying to help you, you know. And so it's sort of a clueless move, you know.
Yeah.
And probably one of the best entrepreneurs I saw, you know, there's somebody I know in Wilmington who has his own company, and he basically said, I'll listen to anybody, you know, if everyone has an opinion, I don't have to take it, but, you know, I don't have to rain on someone's parade either.
I've noticed in reviewing pitch decks, one of the red flags for me is always that total addressable market statistic. And if you see that on page 2, that the total addressable market is $2 trillion worldwide or something, that always says to me, these people are over-managing my expectations and they're not going to get there. So
So that's a clueless move, you know. And Guy Kawasaki has a, you know, series of things of not what not to do when you
do
VCs and so forth. And that's one of them, I think, is, you know, the old, I just need 1% of a huge market.
That's right.
And so there are certainly things you shouldn't do. The second thing that you shouldn't do is obviously raise people's expectations to such heights that you can't deliver on what you're promising. And so that brings us back to the Theranos example, where I think Elizabeth Holmes did a fantastic job of putting an amazing board together and raising enormous amounts of money and getting to that unicorn billion-dollar valuation. But ultimately not having something that worked. And they're doing everything to cover that up and not allow people to see that there was nothing behind the curve.
Yeah, and I think that's a great example of just how enormously damaging it is to create expectations that are out of line with reality or overinflated in some way. I mean, Obviously, Theranos is an egregious example, but everything we've been talking about today could have lesser examples of that. But once those expectations are disappointed, once you've lost the trust, it's devastating. It's the end. You can't recover. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, everyone starts withdrawing their support. Employees start leaving the company. Investors won't reinvest or give you more money. And word spreads very, very quickly, which is, of course, why everyone does everything they can to stop the bad news getting out. But I always remember a quote by Michael Shermer, who writes about skepticism and so forth, who said it's a slippery slope from self-delusion to fraud. And I think there's a danger there that you go down that slope and you convince yourself that it works. And then at some point, you're basically lying to people.
Okay, we've come full cycle then, Steve. We started at how to manage expectations, how to do it well. We've gone through the four stages. We looked at the other end of the telescope where it's negative. So let's go back to the high ground. It seems like this is, it's been very refreshing for me to hear this because it's something, another thing an entrepreneur should be doing every day. You should be thinking about the expectations of their customers and suppliers and employees and friends and family and their bank manager and their investors and always asking themselves, where are those expectations? Have I set them in the right place? Do they need adjusting? See if you can sum up for us in that area. It seems like it's a fundamental task and never to be forgotten for a minute of a day.
Yeah, I mean, when you sit back and think about it in those terms, you realize that it's probably at least 50% of what entrepreneurs are doing every day, right? Dealing with investors, employees, with customers, and so forth, always juggling those expectations, making the small look large and presenting the best possible face to the world. And I think in summary, it's good to think about, entrepreneurs being like explorers, like Christopher Columbus. You spot a new world, you assemble a crew, and then you have a job of keeping the spirits alive until you hit landfall and cash in on those great rewards that may be there to happen. And so it's a process, definitely. And sometimes, obviously, like Christopher Columbus, you're going to get it wrong, but you also have to keep adjusting course and adjusting people's hopes at the same time and keeping the story alive.
Well, Stephen, that's a beautiful metaphor. It's very, very helpful. So let's sign off at that point. Thank you very much for talking to us today. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.